Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Henry Winsheck, an author, editor, and journalist who has written a dozen books on the Founding Fathers, early American life, slavery, and other topics. A winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award, Winsheck has penned a controversial new book called Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves, which is published by FSG. We want to take a moment to thank the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities for helping us do this interview. And thank you so much, Henry Winsheck, for being with us.
Thanks, Alan. I'm delighted to be on your show.
So, Henry, you know, there are some people who have guts. You seem to have guts because you've taken on a guy from the pantheon of American politics and have said, you know, Thomas Jefferson, you had slaves, you had them whipped, you had them in all kinds of places. Some were treated better than others. And maybe you weren't the kind of nice guy that we have all thought you were.
Well, Alan, first of all, thanks for calling me gutsy, because the book didn't start out that way. The book started out taking the very traditional look at Jefferson as a benevolent slave master who was trapped in the institution by his finances, by his weird racial theories, by social convention, et cetera, that he treated his slaves very well. And then all of this nasty stuff came tumbling out of the records, and I just felt frozen in place. I thought, I've never seen this before. Why haven't we learned all this before? This has to come out. I don't want to tell this, but it's there. I have to tell it. And then the book comes out, and people are furious at me, people around here anyway, in Mr. Jefferson's country, for telling it. But as I say to people who come after me, I said, it's all in the documents.
Maybe you can take us just for a little bit of a summary visit to what you learned that our folks would be interested in, and then they'll go out and buy the book.
Well, one of the things I learned was that, you know, Jefferson inherited slavery as all the founders did. And for a number of years, he talked about how evil it was and the necessity of throwing it off. And then he discovered how profitable it was for himself and for the country. And then he began to deliberately perpetuate it. And people often say to me, they say, well, he was just a man of his times. And I say, absolutely. He illuminates his times. Through Jefferson, we can see why slavery and how slavery survived the Revolution, how it got stronger and more prosperous and more robust, and how it carried us into a civil war. The slaveholders knew exactly what they were doing. They embraced slavery. They recognized that it was the strongest economic engine that they could get their hands on. It gave them a magnificent lifestyle. It gave them tremendous social and political power. And all of this we can see through Jefferson. He was utterly corrupted by slavery. It gave him a species of power that no person should have. It's an example, really, of how a great man can be corrupted.
Tell us about the letter to Washington.
That was one of the turning points in my research. In 1792, when Jefferson had just come back from his time in France as our minister there, he was rebuilding his plantation, and he was involved in a three-way correspondence with George Washington and an English agricultural scientist named Arthur Young. And Young insisted that plantations run with slave labor could not possibly be profitable because the slaves just wouldn't work that hard. And Jefferson wrote back this profit and loss memo that said, oh, no, absolutely not. That slave labor is extremely profitable. He said, first of all, it doesn't cost us that much to feed them. It doesn't cost us that much to house them. And then he suddenly began writing out this formula for how much money he made on the birth of black babies. He said that the black population increased by 4% a year. And he wrote out, I allow nothing for losses by death. I shall presently take credit 4% per annum for their increase. And it was a startling, chilling discovery that I thought, you know, here he is, he's counting the babies. And this is what became the economic engine of slavery more than anything else. And Jefferson repeatedly alluded to this.
Did he sell the babies?
No, he didn't sell babies. Well, you know, it's actually on one occasion he sold a 3-year-old girl to one of his overseers. And from the records we have, it seems that the overseer was the girl's father, because she later turns up with his surname. Strange thing. A year and a half after the transaction, the overseer decides he doesn't want her anymore. So he and Jefferson get together, they dicker over the price, and then the deal is annulled. So one day this girl has a father, and the next day she doesn't. It's just one of those ugly things about slavery. It's not something that you can point to Jefferson and say, look at how horrible he was selling a three-year-old girl. This is just part of the whole ugly business of slavery.
So how analogous is it that you raise cows and you sell them at a 4% profit, or you raise human beings and you sell them at a 4% profit? You make 4% from them.
Well, it's very well. First of all, let me straighten out the numbers. Jefferson said that his slave population increased at the rate of 4% a year.
I see.
2 years later, he wrote a letter to a neighbor, urging that family to invest in slaves, and that if they have any money, to lay every penny of it into land and Negroes, as he said, because they increase in value from 5 to 10% a year, and he referred to this as a silent profit. And now it was Washington who put his finger on the exact similarity between selling people and selling animals. And it outraged him that people were sold, as he wrote, like cattle in the market. And this really didn't bother Jefferson.
What's the relationship between Washington and Jefferson at this point?
In 1792, they were still very close. I mean, Jefferson was hired by, or he was, asked by Washington to be his Secretary of State. It was only later, in Washington's second term, that they had a falling out. Jefferson was spreading stories about Washington being senile and, being in the thrall of Hamilton, whom, of course, Jefferson hated. But his relationship with Washington was all bound up with his relationship with Hamilton.
But Jefferson has been painted in history as what, a progressive?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, because he wrote so many, especially in the subject of slavery, because throughout his life, he made a number of pronouncements about how evil slavery was and how he would sacrifice anything to get rid of it. But after the 1780s, all of these pronouncements were in private letters. They were not shouted from the porch of the White House. He made no public pronouncements about any opposition to slavery. Whenever an abolitionist or another progressive would write to him about how terrible it was that he himself was holding slaves, whenever someone wrote to him about how horrible it was that the country and Jefferson were betraying their revolutionary ideals by continuing to hold slaves, Jefferson would write back, "Oh no, we hold our revolutionary ideals very dear, very close to our hearts. It's just that we're trapped in this system." And then Jefferson would say something. He said this a number of times. I stand ready to sacrifice anything to push emancipation forward. And those private statements get quoted endlessly, and so people go around saying things that. And it says this on the Monticello website, that Jefferson was a lifelong foe of slavery. The heck he was. I mean, he stopped opposing slavery in the 1780s.
And how many slaves did he have?
In his lifetime, he owned somewhat more than 600 slaves. At any one time, he probably owned between 100 and 130 slaves. At Monticello, at his other big plantation called Poplar Forest, which is near Lynchburg, Virginia, and at some other properties that he had.
Let's go back to the pressures that he was feeling. What was going on in the rest of the world, the Brits, others, that would make Jefferson say to some people at least, I'd do anything to get rid of this thing?
Well, there were quite a few abolitionists around. Abolitionism wasn't just a fringe movement. There were people of Jefferson's own class in Virginia who were freeing slaves. George Washington is an example. Another one is Edward Coles, who was one of Jefferson's neighbors in Albemarle County, and maybe we can come back to him later on. But the interesting thing that I discovered is that, and actually it was the historian David Waldstreicher from Temple University whose work first awakened me to this understanding that when Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were over in France in the 1780s as our trade representatives, all of our friends at the French court were abolitionists. And a couple of them had actually fought in the American Revolution. And they could not understand how we could have fought a revolution for universal human rights and then kept slavery. And so when Franklin and Jefferson were in France, these abolitionists put them under tremendous pressure. So Jefferson, you know, issued some of his most ringing anti-slavery statements over there in France. But the most interesting thing to me is that in the last year of his time in France, it seems that the abolitionists had finally gotten to him, because he wrote a letter in which he said that when he got back to Virginia, he was going to begin training slaves for freedom. He was going to settle them on acreages of their own, mixed in with German farmers he was going to bring from Europe, to teach the slaves how to live on their own and be productive free people. And at the end of the letter, he said that he had no doubt that they would become good citizens. Now, one of the interesting things about this letter is that he really talked this up. He mentioned it to his friend Thomas Paine. He mentioned it to his private secretary, William Short, both of whom took it very seriously. But when Jefferson got back to Virginia, he rather quickly turned that plan on its head. And he began training slaves not to free them, but to keep them in slavery. He discovered quickly how smart these slaves were. They were not like children, as he'd told the French. They were not stupid and incompetent and unable to plan. Right away, they were able to acquire very sophisticated agricultural skills, and they made his plantation run better than ever. And so he never did get around to freeing these people who were perfectly suited to take care of themselves.
Not even at death?
At his death, he freed five people, all of whom were related to him in one way or another. He might have gotten around to freeing more, but in his lifetime, he freed a couple of other people. He freed his two of his children by Sally Hemings, Beverly Hemings and Harriet Hemings. He allowed them to leave Monticello in 1822. But he wrote into his farm book that they had run away. Robert Hemings and James Hemings negotiated their freedom with Jefferson. He was very reluctant to let them go and was very angry about it, actually.
When slaves ran away, he had them pursued.
Yes, that's right. A number of slaves ran away. I think it was 29 or 30 during the Revolutionary War. And that's that was a special set of circumstances. But outside of the war, really very, very few of his slaves tried to run away. There's a really interesting story of one man, James Hubbard, who ran away twice in the early 1800s. He was one of the trusted slaves. His father had been the foreman of labor at Jefferson's Poplar Forest plantation. And Jefferson brought him up to Monticello to learn nail making, and he did poorly at it at first, but then he really worked hard at it, and he made Jefferson quite a bit of profit, and he took on extra jobs. One of them was charcoal burning, to earn extra money, and he seemed like the ideal docile cooperative slave. But it turned out that he was doing all this extra work to raise money to finance an escape. He bought himself some clothes, which he traded to the son of one of the overseers in exchange for the young overseer's son writing him a fake emancipation document. It turned out the overseer's son wasn't a very good writer, because when Hubbard ran away, a sheriff demanded to see his papers and could tell right away that the papers were forged. So he had Hubbard arrested. And under questioning, Hubbard said, "Well, my master is the president of the United States." So the sheriff of Fairfax County, Virginia, sent a letter to the president in the White House saying, "I've got one of your slaves here." And so Jefferson had him sent back to Monticello. Jefferson gave the guy a second chance. And then, lo and behold, he did the same thing again. He made better plans this time and actually was able to stay free for a year. But Jefferson put the slave trackers on him, and he was caught, brought back to Monticello, and he was sold to an overseer, and then he disappears from the records.
Well, there's so many directions we can go in, but I want to point out to everybody, we're talking to Henry Wincek, who is an author, editor, and journalist who has written a dozen books on the Founding Fathers, early American life, slavery, and other topics. He is the winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award. Wincek has penned a controversial new book called Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves, which is published by FSG. Okay, so I guess in the common parlance, what everybody knows about, something about it, is Sally Hemings. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, I came to the, when I started the book, I looked at the Hemings story not so much from the point of view of a doubter, but I wanted to re-examine all of the evidence because I thought that the evidence was not quite as strong as we had been led to believe. And for a while, I actually did become a doubter. But then I came across some new information which led me to cast aside those doubts. And I agree with Monticello that Jefferson is very likely the father of all of Sally Hemings' children. Sally Hemings came to France when Jefferson was over there as our minister. He did not send for her. It was another of his relatives who chose young Sally, who was then 14, to go over to France as the companion, travel companion to Jefferson's youngest daughter. And then when she was over there, roughly age 15 or 16, they began having a sexual relationship. And according to their son, Madison, she was pregnant when it was time to leave. And she said that she didn't want to leave France because she was free. And she and Jefferson then made a deal that if she agreed to go back to Virginia and be his concubine, as that's the word that her son used, then Jefferson would agree to free all of her children when they turned 21. I think that that's actually what happened. The interesting thing to me is that a number of people have portrayed the relationship as one with emotional closeness, that there was some romance involved. I don't see any of that, any evidence of that, in what Madison Hemings wrote about their relationship. I mean, he referred to his mother as Jefferson's concubine, which is a very, very harsh word. And in another context, he referred to, when he was talking about Thomas Jefferson meeting his white wife, Martha, who died in 1782, he said, an intimacy sprang up between them, which ripened into love, and they were married. So that's how Madison described the relationship of Thomas and Martha. He didn't use those words when he described his mother's relationship with Jefferson. He referred to her as a concubine. So I don't agree with others who find any romance here. And in his account, Madison Hemings really doesn't have much good to say about his father. He doesn't have much to say about him at all. He says that Jefferson more or less ignored him and his siblings. He doesn't relate any intimate anecdotes about his father. Judging by the information he left us, it seems that Madison hardly ever saw him. We have another account by a slave, Isaac Jefferson Granger, who was a blacksmith at Monticello, which is much longer than Madison's account and has a number of anecdotes about Jefferson. Isaac spent a lot of time with Jefferson. They got along very well. But we don't see that in Madison Hemings' account.
So you said something that puzzled me a little bit was that you weren't sure about the veracity of the stories about their relationship. And yet, you know, we've been able to, you know, take somebody's hair and do the DNA and show all of the children. So what was the confusion in your mind?
Well, first of all, the DNA didn't come from anybody's hair. It came from blood samples. And the problem with the blood samples from Thomas Jefferson's family is that we didn't get DNA directly from a Thomas Jefferson descendant. We got it from someone who was descended from his uncle. So Jefferson's defenders have correctly stated that, well, this particular strain of DNA could have been imparted to the Hemings family by Jefferson's brother, Randolph Jefferson, who lived on a plantation called Snowden, some 20 miles away from Monticello. And they, you know, they've been insisting on this since 2000, you know, when, or actually since 1999 when the DNA results were announced. You know, the historical evidence tends to favor the Thomas Jefferson, that Thomas Jefferson was the father. But that that question of Randolph being the father always hung out there, and I was not able to adequately dismiss it. Because Isaac Jefferson, the blacksmith, whom I just mentioned a few minutes ago, mentioned in his memoir that Randolph was known to frolic and play the fiddle in the slave quarter. And now everybody has pointed to this, not everybody, but a lot of people have pointed to this and say, see, I mean, Randolph was actually known to have frolicked in the Monticello slave quarter. Why couldn't he have been the father? And I looked at this very carefully, and I thought, you know, they've really got a point here. But it was only, to make a long story short, after studying this very carefully, I realized, first of all, Isaac in his memoir never said that Randolph was frolicking in the Monticello slave quarter. He just mentioned slave quarter. Mm. And then when I looked more carefully at the full context of his remark, I could see that Isaac was describing events that were taking place away from Monticello. So Isaac was talking about Randolph Jefferson frolicking in his own slave quarter at Snowden, 20 miles away, not at Monticello. So that changed my thinking completely. I thought, well, the strongest evidence for Randolph Jefferson being the father has just evaporated. So there's nothing standing in the way to saying that it was Thomas Jefferson the father. I arrived at this by a process of elimination. One of the things that threw me off is that Jefferson says nothing about Sally Hemings in his records. There are no hints, clues, allusions to a relationship, nothing. And the other thing is that Jefferson was so outspoken in his hatred of racial mixing. And I thought, how could he have children with this woman when he spoke so violently of his hatred for mixed race people? So, I mean, that's something else that we just have to try to figure out.
What do you make of that?
I really don't quite know. I think that part of his anger at the mixed race people at Monticello is that many of them were related to him through his late wife, because Sally Hemings and her siblings were the half-siblings, half-brothers and sisters of Jefferson's wife, Martha. And this gave them control over Jefferson. I mean,
you got to go back for me here. Now I'm getting confused. That's fascinating. Oh, explain that.
Oh, I guess, you see, in Virginia, everybody knows this. When you when you're talking to people outside of Virginia, they're amazed to find this out. Jefferson married a woman named Martha Wales in 1769. Martha's father was named John Wales. He owned a slave named Elizabeth Hemings. John Wales was married three times, and after the death of his third wife, he began a long-term relationship with his slave, Betty Hemings, and that relationship created six children. And when John Wales died, those children came into the possession of his daughter, Martha, who was married to Thomas Jefferson. So Jefferson inherited those six people who were the half-brothers and sisters of his wife. And one of those was Sally Hemings. So it creates a Byzantine cluster of relationships, to say the least. But many of the slaves who lived at Monticello, and certainly the great majority of the slaves who lived at the top of the mountain and were the most favored slaves with household positions, they were all members of the Hemings family, and so they were all related to Jefferson through his wife. And it's my theory that the power that they had over him through their blood relationship to his wife really irked Jefferson. He did not like the idea that slaves had some power over him. And this was it was a blood tie, and that's a relationship you really can't break as much as you would try to.
Do we have any idea what the wife's instructions or hints to Jefferson were about the treatment of these slaves?
No. The only hint we have is that when Martha came to live at Monticello right after they were married. Jefferson replaced his valet with a young Hemings man, Robert Hemings. So I think that that was sort of a signal that Martha wanted to have the Hemingses working in the household and not slaves that she didn't know all that well. But we don't have any explicit instructions from her about how the Hemingses were to be treated.
And do we have any idea about the relationship between Martha and Sally?
No, because there was a great gulf in there. Sally was just a child when Martha died. Mm-hmm. And I think that she is one of the Hemingses who may have taken care of Martha in her final illness when she died in the early 1780s. When Martha died, she was just a kid.
So I want to change topics for a moment and go to the nail factory. This is a source of great pride, as were the slaves, at least at some point, to Jefferson. And in doing this, he was competing, as I understand it, with the state prison.
Yes, that's right.
Both of which, you know, had basically free labor. And Jefferson was very proud of it to the point where he brags, doesn't he, about having, you know, been in the nail factory itself half a day every day.
That's right. He started this nail factory in the 1790s after he had come back from France. And this was part of his total reconstruction, renovation of the Monticello plantation system. He shifted away from tobacco and into planting wheat, and this freed up a lot of labor, including child labor, which wasn't required in the fields that much anymore. So he began to industrialize Monticello. And as an aside, I want to say that when we look at Jefferson, we can see that he pioneered a number of things about slavery, the financialization of it, and one of them was the diversification and the industrialization of slavery. He started a number of industrial enterprises at Monticello, and one of them was this nail factory, which employed boys from 10 to 16 years old, and it immediately became profitable. They were making nails for sale in that part of Virginia, and within months they were making so much money that Jefferson wrote to his merchants that just a few months of labor by the nail boys paid the entire grocery bill for the year for the mansion. And this was a huge amount of money that these boys were making. But one of the things that I discovered is that in order to keep productivity up, the boys were whipped. And this information had been deleted from the public record in the 1950s by an editor who thought, well, this is something that we really shouldn't know. Mm. And the full letter wasn't published until 2005 in the latest edition of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson. And when I was making my way through that new edition, seeing what new information was there, I was astounded when I came to that letter because it had a sentence that had never been in it before about the boys being whipped. This is one of the things that has caused controversy with the people at Monticello, because they are putting forth this theory that Jefferson had devised what Annette Gordon Reed calls a kinder, gentler slavery. And that Jefferson was, quote, perfecting slavery, and that it was rational and humane. All of this is nonsense. It was very cruel. And none of these theories can stand up against the bare fact that children were whipped to get them to work. And the Jeffersonians do not like that fact. They have come at me tooth and nail over this. And I said, it's in the records. You just didn't know about it. And now you've got to deal with it. But it wrecks their theories.
So he also had a class system among the slaves, did he not? In other words, some slaves got more, got better fed, got better clothing than others did. And the nail guys did better, for example, than the field hands.
Absolutely, yes. You see, one of the aspects of the nailery program was that it was, Jefferson explicitly said it was a training place. He told the boys that if you do well in the nailery, then you will graduate, so to speak, to training in one of the high value skills. You know, you could work as a blacksmith or a joiner, a carpenter, or something else that will ensure that you get a spot at the top of the mountain near me, where you get better food, better clothes, good work assignments, some independence from the overseers, and so there was a large segment of the population that lived at the top of the mountain that took care of Jefferson's personal needs in the household and for all of the craft work that he needed done. And then farther down the mountain and across the river, that's where the overseers held sway. That's where the agricultural work was done, and things were much more brutal. And the archaeology has shown that, you know, the people farther down the mountain didn't get as well fed. The housing wasn't as good. And Jefferson himself was explicit about how, that if you don't do well at the top of the mountain, you'll get sent down to work under the overseers. And people didn't want that to happen. So there was a hierarchy of slaves. And as an aside, I found the same thing at Mount Vernon. I mean, I wrote it, my previous book was on George Washington and slavery, and Washington also issued that threat to a house servant who's, you know, basically saying, if you continue to screw up, I'm going to have you sent to the fields and you'll be a common house slave and work under the overseers.
What do we know about the overseers, Henry?
The overseers at Monticello were described by Jefferson himself and by other people at that time as brutal. One of Jefferson's overseers was called a terror by his own neighbors in Albemarle County. One of his relatives said of the Poplar Forest plantation, "I fear the poor Negroes fare hard." And his overseer, Gabriel Lilly, is the one who beat the children to get them to work. He beat a Hemings very nearly to death. Jefferson didn't care as long as productivity was kept up. Lilly beat the nail boys because Jefferson had written and sent instructions saying, keep the small ones engaged. We have a lot of orders to fill.
The book is by Henry Winsheck, Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves, published by FSG. Now, Henry, there's a thesis that sort of comes out, at least to me, hits me right in the head when you read your work, and that is that Jefferson really sort of lived a compartmentalized life, to the point where you describe the tunnels that brought the slaves to bring the stuff up to the house, but they were never seen. In other words, unless if a person came to the plantation, they didn't know he had slaves because he kept them out of sight.
That's right. I dislike this word compartmentalized. I think that it was Joseph Ellis who really popularized that. Because it, and Ellis actually is a brilliant explicator of Jefferson, but because it implies that there were things going on that Jefferson didn't know about or that he was able to successfully block out. As the historian Alan Taylor said about Ellis's interpretation of Jefferson and this business of compartmentalizing, Taylor said that what Ellis gets for Jefferson is a core of naive innocence. I mean, Ellis implies that Jefferson never knew these things were going on or that he was able to block them out. I don't believe that. Jefferson designed a system that was full of tunnels and compartments so his visitors wouldn't have to see this stuff. And also, you know, he didn't like to look at it every day, but he knew what was going on because he was in constant communication with his managers. Even when he was, in Philadelphia or New York or Washington, he knew what was going on. He was getting the profit and loss reports. He was getting reports from his son-in-law who was trying to restrain the overseers. There was nothing going on that Jefferson didn't know about.
It's just a different nuance in terms of what compartmentalized means to me. You know, a guy has a mistress and a wife, and he handles them both, you know, differently, but he's able to do it because they are in different spaces. I guess that's all I meant.
Well, you know what? You may raise a very interesting point, because I don't see Monticello as a world of compartments. I see it as a world of power.
Integrated.
It's Jefferson's power that enables him to do whatever he wants to do, because Sally Hemings can't push back. The nail boys can't push back. They are completely under his thumb. And he has the power to make his own reality in his own world. It's not about compartments. It's about power, and that power corrupted him. He wrote so eloquently about this fantasy world that he created, that we swallow it. We think that it's rational and humane and benevolent, and it was far from that.
So when he wrote "All men are created equal," what was he thinking?
Well, that was in his progressive phase. That's when I think he actually did manage. I mean, he did intend to include the Africans in that, and the African Americans. A couple of years before that, in a document that is known as the Summary View, he wrote a manifesto of the rights of the colonists under the king, and he mentioned that as soon as we stop the slave trade, we should proceed to the enfranchisement of the slaves, meaning we'll make them citizens. And it was just 2 years later that he wrote the Declaration. And it was in 1784, he wrote language for the Ordinance of 1784 that would have stopped slavery from spreading in any new U.S. territories. It's really only in the 1790s that you see him turning away from this progressive, all-inclusive view. Peter Onuf and others would say, well, you know, that Jefferson all his life believes that the slaves had the same natural rights as whites, but that those rights were in suspension and that they would only get them when they were sent back to Africa. So, which is a fine theory. In the meantime, the slaves are bought, sold, and beaten on Jefferson's plantation.
You were going to tell us earlier, Henry Winsack, about Edward Coles.
Edward Coles, yes.
Yes. You said let's return to that, so let's do that.
That's really one of the most fascinating stories. It really brings into focus the fact that Jefferson's way of acting was not the only one at that time. You know, people will often say, well, emancipation was impossible. Well, it wasn't, and Edward Coles shows us why it wasn't impossible. Coles was 20 years younger or 30 years younger than Jefferson. He was the private secretary to President James Madison. When he was attending college at William & Mary, he was infected with the virus of liberty. And, you know, he really imbibed the revolutionary values and says, gosh, you know, this slavery thing is really an abomination. We've got to get rid of it. And I myself will inherit slaves when I turn 21. So he resolved privately that when he got ownership of his slaves, that he would free them. He didn't want to tell his family because he knew that they wouldn't give him his inheritance if he said he was going to get rid of it. But once he took control of his slaves, he began laying plans to free them. First, he was going to free them in Virginia. His neighbors talked him out of that. Then he wrote to Thomas Jefferson and said, I want you to get out in front of an emancipation plan in Virginia. We've really got to get this moving. And as an example, I'm going to free my own slaves. And Jefferson told him not to do it, which is extraordinary. But Coles went ahead and did it. He gathered up his 19 slaves and brought them to Illinois, which was a free state. He set them all free. He gave each head of household 160 acres of land and livestock and equipment so each family could be set up to farm independently. And then, blessings on his memory, he ran for governor of Illinois specifically to beat back attempts to turn Illinois into a slave state. This is what American idealism looks like. Jefferson did not live up to this. And in fact, he told Coles not to do it. I think it's because it would put Jefferson in a bad light.
So if you see Jefferson as sort of, for want of a better word, schizophrenic on this, because we've heard the testimony on both sides, I'm wondering about Jefferson and the presidency. We all know he wasn't proud of his presidency. He didn't want it on his tombstone, so the legend goes, and all the rest. So how does your work play into his views on the presidency?
Well, he used the presidency to do two things about slavery. One is he ended the international slave trade as soon as it could be ended. And two, he expanded slavery into the Louisiana Territory. After he bought Louisiana, there was a lot of pressure not to allow slavery there. And Thomas Paine, his old friend from Paris, wrote to him and said, now is the time to put into force that plan you talked about in France, where we could train slaves for freedom. We can do it in Louisiana. Have slaves brought there for 2 years, trained in farming, and then set them free and get them some land. And we can, in this way, gradually, end the slavery problem. Jefferson didn't see it that way at all. He saw, you know, slavery as the great economic engine that would settle the new Southwest. And so he put slavery there. And it was as long ago as 1975 that the great historian Robert Macaulay said, why don't we call Jefferson the father of slavery in Louisiana? Because that's what he was. But we don't like to think that way.
How does that reflect on Jefferson not being proud of his presidency? Have you thought about that at all?
I don't think that has much to do about it. And I'm not so sure he wasn't proud of his presidency. Mm-hmm. I know he didn't put it on his tombstone, which is a puzzle to me. And I mean, he mentioned founding the UVA, writing the Declaration, and also writing the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which is something I honor the man for. I honor him for all three of those accomplishments. It is a puzzle to me why he didn't put down that he was president, and I don't quite understand it.
Talk to me about Paine, who comes across as sort of, to Jefferson, what Jiminy Cricket was to Pinocchio, sort of whispering in his ear and saying, what was that relationship like?
Well, I actually don't know how close they were. I do know that they knew each other in France. And Paine obviously thought that he had some influence over President Jefferson because he wrote him this very passionate letter about the Louisiana Purchase and saying don't put slaves there. And Jefferson didn't make any reply. I should also say that his private secretary William Short also urged Jefferson to put into force that plan that he outlined to train slaves for freedom, and that William Short said to Jefferson, "What is this craziness you have about race mixing?" He said, "Race mixing is fine. You mix the races, and the outcome is, and the offspring are even more beautiful." But Jefferson didn't want to pay attention to that either.
So you're a terrific scholar. You've done all of this great work, and you're willing to suffer the slings and arrows that come your way. But why are our modern scholars so invested in the reputation of the Founding Fathers?
Oh, well, the Founding Fathers they are extremely important. And, my previous book on Washington, An Imperfect God, is one long hymn of praise to George Washington. I mean, the more you get to know Washington, the more you study him, the more you admire the man. And he struggled for 10 years to find a way to free his slaves and ran into opposition from his own family. So he finally did it in his will. And the criticism that I've been getting is not so much because I said something critical about the founders, but it's because I've said things that are critical of some of the theories that Jefferson scholars have about Jefferson. A number of people are really pushing this idea that Jefferson was a benevolent, rational, humane slaveholder. I started out believing that totally because I had read all that stuff. And it was only when I began to study how the plantation was actually run, and it was only when I began to find all of this unpleasant stuff in the documents that hadn't been published before, that I realized that these theories don't hold water at all. It was a brutal place. Jefferson knew that it was a very harsh regime, and he just wanted his profits.
So what does this say about the Academy? You've come up with a superb book, which makes some very important points and some findings based on, documents and other things, and you're getting, an awful lot of garbage for it. Has that led you to think ill of your critics, and especially those who, hold PhDs in history who, should be saying, oh, this is interesting, as opposed to you've slain our dragon?
Oh, no, you know what? No, I have nothing against the Academy because I have a lot of supporters in the Academy.
Sure.
I mean, don't misunderstand. A number of very prominent figures in the Academy have spoken out in favor of my book and in support of it. It's really just the small segment that's clustered around Monticello and a few people at UVA and some people at Harvard and Yale who don't like it because it threatens their particular theories. But outside of the Jeffersonian orbit, the book has been well received. There was a glowing review in American Scholar by Timothy Breen, who's one of the leading historians of the colonial period and specifically colonial Virginia. So, and Jacqueline Jones of the University of Texas has spoken out very forcefully in favor of the book. So there are a number of people who think that it has very important new discoveries and new perspectives on Jefferson. But it's some of the entrenched Jeffersonians who don't like it.
I'll give you a psychological test here. I've always thought, maybe you don't accept this, that there's a sort of similarity between George Washington and a more modern president, Dwight Eisenhower. I think they were both very good men who thought things through and, you know, had a sense of what was right or wrong. You accept that?
That's a good analogy. I mean, I'm always wary of these cross-generational analogies, but...
But in terms of their character, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, I think their basic character was pretty honest, pretty good. So my psychological question to you is, who is Jefferson most like in modern history?
Oh, that's a tough question. I'm going to dodge that. I'm not going to make any comparisons at all. I don't like to do it.
Okay.
I think you just get in trouble. It's a good parlor
game.
Well,
that's why I like to do it. So, Henry, there are a couple of other very noted Virginians who came after Jefferson. Do you think any of what he went through with his slaves affected, you know, people like Madison and others?
No, I think, you know, well, the times were changing slavery, I think, became, despite the Nat Turner Rebellion, slavery became more and more entrenched in Virginia. Part of it was because for the elite families, the buying and or the meaning the selling of slaves became such an important part of their financial status. When Edward Coles, whom I mentioned a few minutes ago, sure, was very close to James Madison, and he extracted a promise from President Madison that at Madison's death, Madison would free his slaves. And then Madison didn't do that, and Coles was just outraged that he didn't do that. Slavery became more entrenched financially, as I said, that because, and Jefferson's grandson mentioned this, that the slaveholders were turning Virginia into one big menagerie where people were being bred for the market. Slave breeding had taken hold of Virginia, and it was Jefferson's grandson who said it. So there was really, the revolutionary fervor began to die out, and the Nat Turner Rebellion scared some people. So the chains just were fastened much more tightly.
So here is a crucial question. You've spent all this time with a guy, locked in a room with him. Do you like him?
Not particularly. It's funny. In John Meacham's book on Jefferson, at the end he says, if I had the chance to sit down and have drinks with Washington and Jefferson, I would certainly pick Jefferson because he's so much more interesting. I would go the opposite way. I wouldn't trust anything that Jefferson told me. And I would be fascinated to hear Washington's stories of the Revolution. I ended up not particularly liking him, but I tried to keep my personal feelings out of the book.
How does one do that? It's almost impossible.
It takes some discipline. I admire him for a number of things. You know, obviously for writing the Declaration, for democratizing the country, for writing the Statute of Religious Freedom, for being such a powerful apostle of liberty. But he was corrupted by his power. He's an example of that, and I think that's something that we need to look at more closely because we cling to this idea that slavery was something that he inherited, that he was stuck with. No, he loved it. It gave him wealth, it gave him power, it gave him status, and it did the same thing for the country as a whole. So he decided, as a mature man, that he was not going to give it up.
In terms of slavery and international relations, you talked about the French. What about the English and Jefferson?
Well, there were a number of abolitionists in England. One of them was Richard Price, who wrote to Jefferson about slavery and putting pressure on him. But you know, Jefferson was very good at making fun of abolitionist movements that irked him. He mentioned that that emancipation was the particular hobby horse of the British, and then he mentioned to a visiting British diplomat that the black people were more or less like mules and were suited only to carry burdens. So, you know, Jefferson hated everything British. So when British abolitionists came to him, that gave him two reasons to be irked, you know.
Right. So he remembered the revolution, but at the same time, he was mad at them on some of the abolition stuff.
Exactly. Right.
Fascinating. So what's your next project?
Well, I have a couple of things in mind, neither of which really involve slavery. And I don't like to talk about things until they are more fully formed, but I have a couple of writing projects in mind.
Right. You know, you just said that Washington, you'd choose Washington for a conversation as opposed to Jefferson. Jefferson was a hell of a talker, liked to talk about everything, had theories about everything. I don't know that you would have gotten a tremendous amount out of Washington.
Well, you know what? That's not true. That's a myth, because there is a really good memoir by a Polish nobleman named Niemcewicz, who spent 10 days at Mount Vernon with General Washington at the end of his life in 1798, who said that, you know, everybody told me that the guy doesn't talk. Absolutely not. He's fascinating. He's a wonderful conversationalist. He won't talk about politics, but he said, you ask him about the war or ask him about farming, and he'll talk all evening. So that's a myth. And I think that with ask the right questions, that Washington would be a fascinating conversationalist.
Well, you have been too. And our guest has been Henry Wincek, whose new book is Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves. We want to take a moment to thank the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities for helping us do this interview. What a terrific story. And anybody who wants to hear, this is only a small part of it. Anybody who wants to hear a lot more is going to go out and buy that book, Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves. Henry, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much, Alan. I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.